Welcome to The Author's Tale, brought to you by Edition Audiobooks. I'm Stephanie Frewen, and this is part two of fantasy writer Helen Lowe's tale. We ended part one listening to Helen read some of her poetry, and if you haven't listened to it, I highly recommend you do. In this segment, we talk about her first novel, Thornspell, how she came to write it, the difficulties of getting published, and the benefits of having a fabulous agent, amongst other things. A reminder that this conversation was recorded in a meeting room at a public library during a very loud storm. So yes, you will hear people moving around and talking, along with the wind and rain against the windows. You will also hear an odd rubbing sound which is coming from a leather jacket. It's too chilly to remove it. You have probably noticed the music taking us into my discussion this week, Tchaikovsky's Sleeping Beauty. The significance of this will soon be revealed.
Thank you. So, yep, poetry, short stories, novels. So let's have a chat now. Can we talk about Thornspell?
We can.
So this is, someone actually wrote on one of the reviews, when I was reading reviews for Air of Night, someone wrote on one of the reviews that was your first novel. I'm thinking, no, it wasn't. I always think this is your first, even though it's for children, I suppose.
But well, it was first published, yes.
Yeah.
The Air of Night is the first in the Wall of Night series, yes. So that might have been what they meant.
Yeah.
But in fact, it's technically correct that the Air of Night is the first book I wrote, but Thornspell was published first.
Thornspell
is the second book I wrote.
How interesting. So you had actually already written Air of Night.
Hmm.
But yet it wasn't. Had it been put out for, like, has it been?
I had been trying to get it published.
Yeah.
Without success.
Was that in New Zealand or beyond?
Overseas.
Yeah.
Because I've been told that there wasn't any point trying to get fantasy or science fiction, yeah, any kind of that sort of fiction published in New Zealand.
Yeah.
So I was trying in the UK, yeah, mainly the UK, yeah, at that stage. And then, and so I went through a certain, and of course it's the first in a series, and yeah, you can kind of understand that people might go, well, you know, this is okay. Yeah. I did get some positive feedback, yeah, but you know, I thought, well, maybe I should show them I can finish something. So I thought I'll write another book,
yes,
and see, you know,
yes,
I'll write something else.
So you're not
finish
just one
it.
Horse pony, can't,
yeah,
you?
And a standalone, yes, yes, one trick pony.
One thank you, not one trick pony. And so since it came out of my mouth, I went, that's not right.
Yeah. One horse town.
One horse town, one trick pony, yeah.
Yeah.
Not just a one trick pony.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I did write, I just chose it at random,
yeah,
again. I chose both of them at random from books started and never, you know, yep, as a, you know, earlier. And yeah, so yeah, I chose this one, and I wanted it to be standalone.
Yes.
And it's a retelling of Sleeping Beauty from, yeah, the perspective of the prince, as, yes, you'll know, having,
yes,
read it.
Yep.
But yeah, and I was fortunate enough that I was able to get that published.
Yeah.
So I have an agent in the United States.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about the place of your agent in all of this.
Well, she took me on the strength of Thornspell. I hadn't tried the United States for the Wall series at, yeah, that stage, so. And she sold Thornspell to Knopf within 3 weeks, which was pretty cool.
Yeah,
after
totally.
The years.
Gosh, I bet you were so excited.
I was extremely excited.
Yeah, I bet. Yay! I can hear it now.
Yeah, and then yeah, she had a look at that,
yes,
book, and she said, you know, I'm just not, with a New York accent, yeah, which, yeah, I'm not going to try and do, but she said, you know, I'm just not convinced, Helen, that the right people have seen this book.
Ah, and that's why you need an agent.
An agent, exactly.
So can we just take a little step back, and this is really for those people who are listening who are writers, who are at that point where they've maybe written something and don't know how to go about getting it in front of those right publishers.
Mm.
So as far as getting your agent, so she's an American.
Yes.
How did you get her?
Well, I used to Google. And but basically what I did was I had no idea how to go about getting an agent, but I thought what I will do is I will look at a number of writers in my genre whose works I really like, and I will find out who represents them. And about 10, yes. 7 of 10 of them were with an agency called Writer's House in New York. So I wrote to Writer's House. Now my story, which some people will have heard before, is that I sort of looked to try and find the right person. I actually ended up choosing the wrong person. She didn't represent junior fantasy, which Thornspell is, but her reader liked the book, and she thought the book had some merit, the manuscript or what I'd sent, so she sent it round to the other agents, and one of them picked it up, and or her reader picked it up, and then Robin eventually, you know, after the reader had read it.
Do you think that this is what I find, and I kind of hear some people screaming at me when I say this, but because our market in New Zealand is so small, I sometimes feel it's lovely to hear that your agent, that potential agent, recognised she wasn't the right one, sent it off, because she could see it had merit, thought, I'm not the right person, sent it off to other agents for you, really worked
within her own business. Within the writer's house.
But she just didn't toss it aside. She still kind of, you know, she really tried to find someone for you. And whereas, unfortunately, because our market is so small here, there might only be two agents within. Do you know what I mean? Like, you're kind of stuck a little bit, and it's, you'd like to think that those people, if they can't help you, they'd go, actually, I know someone in LA or Melbourne or wherever who would really suit.
Well, I do have a kind of story like that as because...
We love hearing stories like
that. Well, the editor at the time, the senior editor for Harper Voyager, Harper Voyager is like the sci-fi fantasy label, imprint, of Harper Collins. So Stephanie Smith, her name was, and I was sort of... had sent some material to her for air to her, and she had liked it quite a lot, but we didn't quite get to publication. But I'd met her, and when Thornspell came out, so she was actually very supportive. I actually had some very supportive feedback from a number of people. There was an editor in the UK with Transworld, I think. Orion, maybe, Glance, something, they're all sort of the same, they overlap. But anyway, Simon Spanton, his name was, and he gave me some great feedback on air and was very encouraging. So, but anyway, Stephanie put me onto their children's division in Australia, and this, and I don't know whether they would normally do this or it was because I came through Stephanie, but the editor there, they said, it's not right for us. But she said, I would really try America with this. And I went, oh, America. And then I went, that's really big. And then I went, Westward Ho.
Brilliant.
Well, no, I didn't. I kind of went, I think that was the point where I think, I really think I need to get an agent. So
fabulous. And what I thought was interesting about your agent, because I looked up to see who your agent was, and what I thought was really interesting, and clearly you got your agent after you'd written this, but the fact that Rue, her name is...
Oh, yeah, that's pure chance.
Yeah,
Robin Rue and Rue.
How weird. Because then I was thinking... Did she write? Did she include Rue as the name because Rue helps out the prince? You know, is there sort of as this guiding kind of light in a way? You know, find opening the doors when the doors need to be opened. And I was thinking all of these kind of
Robin Rue is my agent. Rue is the name of the heroine in Thornspell, but she's named for the herb. So it was long before I got Robin as my agent.
Isn't that odd?
Yeah, no, she's named for the herb. Because Bitter Rue, because of her backstory. Well, not that she is bitter, but her story is bitter. And so that was why choosing the herb Rue for her name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the whole mystical thing, which I've written down here, rue is considered the queen of herbs, which I thought was just fabulous. And guard against poisons, illness, wards off witches, which I think, there you go.
Yeah.
But also about the Catholic Church mixing it with holy water.
I didn't know about that.
Yeah, to ward off. Well, see, I was raised as Catholic, so anything to do with the Catholic Church. I kind of, that's interesting. Was mixed. They mixed it with holy water to get rid of evil.
Yeah.
Which is just fascinating.
Rue was a very potent. I didn't know that.
So then when you met Robin Rue, you thought, we are meant to be together, Robin.
No, I was just like so blown away that she loved my book and wanted to represent it and stuff.
How exciting. Mm. That's wonderful. That is wonderful. So looking at Thornspell, so yes, as you said, it is a retelling of the Sleeping Beauty story from the point of view of the prince, his story, I suppose. What I thought was interesting is that only on a couple of the reviews that I read for it, which I think I printed out here, does it mention that. But otherwise, it's not mentioned at all in
the blurb.
In the blurb.
That it's Sleeping Beauty? Yeah.
There's no mention at all about it being a retelling of a fairy tale.
Oh, right.
And it wasn't until I was reading it, I went, this sounds like Sleeping Beauty.
Oh. It's absolutely Sleeping Beauty.
Yes. And then, of course, after I read it, that's when I went in. Because I don't like reading reviews before I read a book. I wouldn't read them after I read it, because I've made my own mind up then about the book.
Yeah.
So when did you first get the idea for doing that?
Well, it's one of those yes and no answers again, although it's not that sort of question.
Yep.
But Sleeping Beauty, I loved listening to fairy stories on the radio, stories on the radio when I was a kid, and often they were fairy stories, and Sleeping Beauty was my favourite.
Mm.
So thank you National Radio in New Zealand, because that was when I used to listen to their Sleeping Beauty, and I think I even requested it once.
Yeah.
So I loved the story from a very early age, but I got the idea for the story. I went to the ballet of Sleeping Beauty and when I was living in Dunedin.
Fabulous.
It was a lovely production. But I was working really hard and I was quite tired, and I love the music, but I went to they switched the lights off and there's all these people and it's warm and dark, and I may have been having a wee nod off but then the first scene where the prince comes into the story, so there was a sudden upbeat in the music and this dancer comes leaping onto the stage, and I sort of sat up in my seat and I went, what about the prince? Was like, I thought, well, what about the prince? Because in the story, it's always about, the princess, the evil fairy, and then conveniently there is a prince who comes along at the end and manages to break the spell.
Yeah.
No detail on how, or, cuts way through Hedge of Thorns, which has feated everybody else. So that was the first. And then almost immediately I had this idea of this boy. Why would he care? That was the question. What about the prince? Why would he care?
He has to have a motivation behind his action,
His relationship to the forest, the thorns, all the rest of it. So that, and so I had that opening image of the prince and the castle and small castle and the nearby forest and the witch. The Witch of the Wood.
Yeah.
But then I started thinking about the Wicked Fairy.
Yeah.
So over the next few days, my brain was kind of churning with all this. And I thought, well, what about the Wicked Fairy? Because I'm really convinced that if I had gone to all that trouble and effort to cast my death spell that got converted to a sleeping spell for 100 years and all the rest of it, that I maybe wasn't going to give up that easily. I'd be coming back for another go if I could. So then my questions were, well, why did she do it in the first place? I mean, I know the traditional thing is she wasn't invited, but I thought she has to have more motivation than that to be so persistent. So so that was sort of the story around her and her involvement and the king, how it affected the kingdom. And so...
Well done.
Mm.
So then, and so ha, no. So when did you actually write this book? How many years ago?
Early noughts. So it was published in 2008. So I probably wrote it 2005.
2005. Yep. Mm. Okay. So nearly 20 years ago.
Yeah, and I started The Air of Night in 1999. Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, were you working a real job as well at the time,
or
were
definitely you... with Air?
Yeah.
I wasn't with Thornspell.
No.
Because For family reasons, I had had to take time out and things. So,
What I loved about this, so complex. Thornspell is listed here in our library as being in the older fiction of kids' fiction, I suppose,
or
you'd say. But when they put it into the older fiction, for some reason, when I was looking for it, I instantly thought, oh, surely that means we're into the young adult department.
It's crossover.
Yeah, it's crossover. You know. But
there's not enough sex in it to be young adult. I'm sorry.
Oh, isn't it crazy? But there's plenty of violence.
Yeah, you know, I always laugh about that because, especially in America, like often with reviews and that, they'll go, they'll have a little bit about, oh, you know, the what level of sexual sort of thing there is in it.
Yeah.
And no one ever mentions the violence.
Yeah. It's quite violent. Like when I was reading it, I was going, this is really violent. The graphic descriptions of she plunged the sword in somewhere and then she gave it another shove, you know, and it came up through his nose. Or somewhere, I'm thinking, yeah, I've watched all of those kind of programs about Vikings, and that's exactly what they do. You know?
Yeah, I kind of like. I guess I like. I don't think my books glorify violence.
No, not at all.
But I do think. I guess I feel like it's important for violence to be real.
Yes.
You know? Yeah. So when the boar hunt and that, someone is killed by the boar. Yeah. The hunting is a really dangerous thing to do.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Boars were dangerous.
Come back.
Yeah, no. And so I'm trying to capture that feeling, but not, not. So it's not violence for the sake of it, but it is to try and sort of make it realistic, so it's not like that cartoon violence where anything can happen to someone and they can just leap up and be okay.
Yeah,
and so I'm in all my writing I guess what I'm talking about really is consequences.
Yes.
So it's consequences for physical violence, it's consequences also for emotional and you know, the other sorts of traumas that people have. So
And also, if it was interesting, this is in which I thought came out to me quite loudly, was a comment on social status and woman's place in the world and, your social place in the world. So in particular when the friend, who wasn't really the friend, whose name now...
Floor,
thank you. He was really a villain. He, you know, his comments right from the minute he steps into the frame, really, about the wench and the, you know, the servants. And
he's not a kind person.
No, not at all. Mm. And totally, he makes, states very loud and clear what he thinks as being everybody's place in the world and him as being superior and the prince as being superior and what have you. And I thought that was interesting that you have a social commentary.
Mm. Well, it's not a classless society.
No.
And I think that that's where my appreciation of history or my knowledge of history comes in, because I have that this is set in a not quite real realm, but it's sort of Middle Europe in the kind of early Renaissance, the Renaissance era. Yeah. So I make mention of things like telescopes and tennis.
Yes.
So they technologically...
I was really interested about you mentioning tennis.
Because that was the new hot game in that late Middle Ages, early Renaissance era. Yeah, hugely popular. And I think, was it tennis and golf? There were two sports, and golf and football. No, it was golf and football in Scotland. They actually made a law about people only being able to play them to a certain period because it was taking away from their archery and other practice.
Yeah. Yes, I think I read that just recently somewhere. But the tennis, when I was reading this and I got to the bit of the tennis, I went, tennis?
Yeah.
I just questioned it. I went, really? Tennis?
Yeah.
I thought, well, it would have been happening because she wouldn't have put that in if it wasn't
true. Yeah, yeah. Put it in it kind of deliberately. Yes. To, there was sort of a little bit of a sliding scale of history from late Middle Ages through to the sort of more full-on Reformation era in the cultural and social fabric of the book. But by and large, it's probably at the earlier era. So, and so things like the telescopes and the tennis and that are kind of just to give you a little bit of texture. But but there was definitely, when you were poor in those days, you were really poor.
Absolutely.
You know, and I was, so reading a lot of history about the, about that yeah. kind of thing. So.
And the other thing that struck me as well with this book, as well as your other books actually as well, but I suppose really a lot in here, whether this was intentional or not, was this whole year crossing between worlds and realms, and almost, I guess, from a, if you were to talk to someone who was very heavily involved with spiritual travel, astral travel, or someone, all of that kind of thing, the mystic qualities of crystals and herbs and scent, and the fact that people can move between worlds. That was really strong in this book, and his dreams, the fact that he almost astral travelled.
It's dream magic. Dream magic is the predominant form of, probably the predominant form of magic in the book.
We're going to pause our chat briefly for us to listen to a very small snippet of Thornspell, read by Elliot Gray. I definitely won't be a spoiler, but I will tell you that in this segment we join the Prince Sigismund. He's following his friend Rue as they try to escape to safety.
Substance and Shadow. There was a howl like a great wind rushing through the earth and a clangor of blowing horns. Rue fled, a pale glimmering down the corridor, and Sigismund followed. The corridor twisted and turned with flights of stairs up and down, and sometimes Sigismund was uncertain whether he was running through rock and earth or a dark, twisted wood that reached out to clutch and trip. He focused his awareness as Balison had taught him and found it helped separate illusion from substance on either side. Mainly, however, he concentrated on staying on his feet and following Rue. The howling was louder now, banging at their heels, and Sigismund could hear voices in it crying and cursing after him as the walls alternately closed in, then drew back. The pursuit would catch up soon, he thought, unless Rue could get them out. He snatched a quick look back, but saw nothing, just a deeper blackness pressing after them around every corner. The breath was beginning to tear in his lungs, sweat stinging his eyes, so that at first he didn't even see the line that seared the air between himself and Rue. He swerved aside as it blazed bright, stumbling into the wall. By the time he pulled himself upright again, Rue had vanished and the Margravine stood before him. The howling in the dark, narrow corridor were gone. He was standing in what looked like a wooden belvedere with fluted pillars holding up a shingled roof. Great trees pressed close on every side, obscuring any view of moon or stars, and there were leaves and vines tangled across the floor. The Margravine stood in a nimbus of pale light that cast a soft glow around her face and body, like clouds around the moon, thought Sigismund, awed by her beauty in spite of himself. But her face, like that of the moon, was hidden in shadow. She extended a hand, and he was drawn towards her whether he wished to go or not. It didn't help, Sigismund found, to know that magic was being used against you if you could do nothing to stop it. He gritted his teeth, thinking of the long hours spent meditating on the tower roof and how he would not give in then either. Inside him, the serpent of power uncoiled, hissing. Sigismund stopped moving forward and regarded the woman in front of him. She was beautiful, he thought, detached now, but he remembered his mother's death and the boar that had killed Watt, let loose in the forest of thorn. "Prince Sigismund," the Margravine said, "I congratulate you. You really have been quite clever." She was smiling, and her tone was sweet, but he guessed that she was far from pleased. "Someone has taught you well, it seems." Saying nothing, Sigismund decided, was the wisest course. He was certainly not going to tell her about Rue, and he could see no point in mentioning Balison. The Margravine took a step closer, and he saw that her blue eyes had turned so dark that there were black hollows in her face. "Clever," she repeated, still smiling, "but discourteous to abandon my hospitality when we still have business to discuss." "I have nothing to discuss with anyone who traps and then imprisons me," Sigismund said, his voice a rusted metal against her sweetness. She widened her eyes at him, stepping forward again. "So hasty. But can you be sure of that? What if I offered you peace in your father's kingdom, an end to the wars in the south? Sigismund stared at her, thinking how long those wars had bled his country dry, absorbing the energy of its kings. In exchange for what? He asked slowly. Her smile deepened. So you are interested, she murmured. I thought you might be. And the exchange I ask is such a little thing. She was watching him closely, and her voice crooned on a sing-song note when she spoke again. Such a little thing.
Dream magic is the predominant form of, probably the predominant form of magic in the book.
So when it came
and
to...
And it is in the war series as well.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So, so when it came to you researching that and knowing about that, is that something that you just naturally are kind of curious about, or is it something that's just through your study of those eras and mythologies and that you learnt about?
I think it's more the latter.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm interested in a lot of things, and I do read about them, you know, sort of Zen philosophy. But I think mainly the dream magic is strongly grounded in myth, the mythic, and, you know, there's a lot of stories about it in myth and legend and fairy. And there's also, the other main thing is the fairy magic, the fairy hills, the time shifts and things like that, which is just absolutely prevalent in fairy tales.
So I incorporated that. Yeah.
So there's that element to it, but
there was one, what have I got there? Oh, that's about the lapis lazuli, about that being above the door. And I loved all that, but the oldest spiritual stone, used by healers, priests and royalty for power, wisdom, and it stimulates your psychic ability and inner visions. And of course that
I have read a lot about that kind of thing. So yes, you've just reminded me, years ago I read a few books. I was really interested in gemstones.
Yes.
And as part of my general reading about gemstones, there was a lot of work about their traditional spiritual associations and how they were used in religion. And so, like, the Virgin's robe in art was always ground up lapis. That's where they got the blue from, that Virgin's blue. So, anyway, that's just it.
Don't you just love all of that, though?
It is fascinating.
I think it's completely fascinating because we still have it in our world today. And we have no idea where it stems from. Like, there's a reason for it all.
There's lots of resonances, but we don't acknowledge it, do we?
Yeah. So I'm just going to try and find this. But here, what have I got? Oh, astral treatment about planes overlapping. That's right. This is the other thing I find really hard, I suppose, to get my head around with fantasy writing. It's the names and the place names and the people's names. And I'm thinking, like, how do I say? I'm going to say Sigismund.
It's Sigismund.
Sigismund.
Yeah.
You know, these are all, they don't come easily.
No, off the tongue,
do they?
It's interesting because that was, I deliberately went for a Middle European name.
Yeah.
And so at that time, there were lots of sort of kings of Poland and Lithuania and things. And Sigismund was a very common name and it seemed to suit the character.
Yeah.
But I guess with retrospect, as having written quite a few books now and I think maybe now I would go for a simpler name, you know? Yeah, just because for the main character, like Rue is very simple, right?
Yeah.
It's still a really good name.
Yeah.
I think Sigismund is a little bit unusual for readers.
But it does sound very princely.
Yes. So, yeah, I don't know. Maybe I would, maybe I wouldn't. But, you know, I definitely didn't, you know, wasn't going to have the main character called Wenceslas or,
no.
one of those very
That too, because, of course, we all know the good King Wenceslas. We all know the song.
Yeah.
And if you don't know the song, well...
And it is quite a common name from that part of the world. So I was kind of using the world. Whereas in Air, I made them all up myself.
Because this is the thing. When you are creating worlds, it's like there's quite a fine line, I suppose, between because you are writing for people who are often they are experts in Greek mythology, or you know, sometimes you're you know, so you have to do your fact checking and all the rest of it. So how does that sort of, I guess, impinge on your creativity? How does it stifle your creativity when it comes to naming a world? You have to make sure, I would imagine, that it sounds like it's of the same era or the right era, the right place.
Definitely. And names can be wrong. Yeah. They can be so wrong. So, like, there's a character in... I can't remember what I called her now, originally, but she's the honour captain in Heir of Night.
Yeah.
Azantia.
How do we? Oh,
I say Azantia.
Yeah.
That's because I'm Kiwi and all my vowels slide towards the middle. Probably if I was in another country, I'd say Asantia or, you know, something like that. But she's the honour captain.
Yeah.
And initially, she was meant to be a very minor character.
Yeah.
But there were too many characters with names that sounded the same.
Yes.
So I changed her name, and immediately I changed her name. The character changed. She became much more important. It was sort of like Athena from the Brain of Zeus type thing. She sort of leapt out.
Yeah.
And it was sort of more or less like, well, you better start paying attention because I'm really important to the story. And I've got this.
Isn't that funny? The character talked to you.
Yeah, well, not they, not like, but
no,
you know.
No, I know what you mean. But you know what I mean? They come to life more.
No, she definitely, it was just
isn't
like
funny?
Being like minor character, not that important, and suddenly really vibrant character and really important.
Yes. And it's interesting that in this book, when you with Aurora, the princess, that you she says to, you know, Sigismund, call me Aura, which is lovely because it just it sort of gave him that sort of more relaxed feel and everything, but also it just kind of, for some reason, I could just picture her with this aura, you know, glowing and like an aura as opposed to the Aurora. But anyway.
She has to be Princess Aurora, and it's like Flor.
Yeah.
Is like Florian. Mm. Often the name of the princess is like Florian or Florizel or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's F-L-O-R.
Yeah.
But of course, there's actually two, there's kind of two stories in the Sleeping Beauty cycle.
Yeah.
And one of them is a lot more brutal, shall we say, very Brothers Grimm, than the sort of sanitized Disney version. Mm. And so what I was trying to do with Flor and Sigismund is bring the two threads into the story and sort of work them.
Yeah. So look, so at one... the Sir Julius Vogel Award for Best Novel, Young Adult, in 2008. And it also won the award for Best New Talent, the Sir Julius Vogel Award for Best New Talent, as well in 2008. In 2008, the Storylines New Zealand Literature Trust Notable Book as well. And it was the... In 2007, it was a runner-up in Storylines Tom Fitzgibbon Award for the unpublished manuscript of Thornspell. Yeah. So... it obviously hit the right spot.
Yeah, and it also won a couple of reader... well, it won an reader award in the US.
Yes.
And now I can't... it was a children's thing where the children's did the reviews.
Ah.
Yeah, so the readers themselves gave it Flaming Net or something it was called. They've changed their name now, and I was trying to remember what they call it. They've got more serious.
Yes.
And the other one was in the US, it won a Children's Literacy Best in Year Award from a sort of focusing on the literariness of the book. So,
And I see the Sacramento Books Reviews gave it 5 stars. Great YA fantasy story. That was in 2008.
Yeah.
And in it, it says, in Helen Lowe's first novel, she takes a behind-the-scenes look at the classic Sleeping Beauty and puts it in the perspective of the prince, the one who awakens her from her sleep. With engaging characters and an energetic and magical plot, this book should capture the attention of all readers, breaking away from a genre of young adult. It does break, This book honours Prince Charming's qualities and does not damage the old story in any way. With a handful of plot twists and dangers lurking behind every page, this book will keep the reader engaged well after the final page, and Helen Lowe will be sure to have a cult following waiting anxiously for her next instalment in her fantasy series. What a great review!
It is a great review.
A really good review!
It got some really good reviews. So,
Totally. In the School Library Journal in 2000, they've got it titled A Believable Hero. And he
was really believable, that boy, and that he was very, very believable. Actually, I laughed because someone wrote to me and they said, I'm very concerned that your hero doesn't like reading books. Like, you're a reader and, you know, you're a reader yourself and a writer, and your hero doesn't like reading books. And I'm kind of going, yeah, because that's his character. Yeah. He's a medieval prince and has, it's all about riding horses and weapons and hunting and things. But he can read. He can read.
He's just busy doing other things.
And he's busy doing other things. And he'd much rather be outside, you know, galloping around and doing things. And so I kind of, I did sort of smile, but I kind of thought, but that's all about who the character is. And I would have to write a very different story to have a bookish hero.
Yes, you would. Oh, my goodness me. There was something else that entered my head about that, but I can't remember what it was.
You have been listening to part two of season two of The Author's Tale, featuring Helen Lowe, presented and produced by me, Stephanie Fruin. Hope you've enjoyed Helen's tale. Don't forget to follow to get instant notifications of future episodes, including part three of Helen's story, where we will discuss her Wall of Night series. You can find out more about Helen on her website, www.helenlowe.info. The link is in the show notes. Thank you for listening to The Author's Tale, brought to you by Edition Audiobooks and Digital Publishing, helping you bring your books to life. EditionAudiobooks.com.